Scene 1. Exterior Mindanao Island.
The evening vapors in Crow Valley were sticky and balmy, as per usual. Crickets chirped persistent, arthropodal love songs to one another in the low grasses. The moon above Mount Pinatubo, on Mindanao Island in the Philippines, hung low in the darkened sky, and Second Lieutenant Francis Xavier O'Rourke felt drained and spent beyond any level of exhaustion he'd known in his life, either before the helicopter crash in which he died, or after it. Deep in his bones, Fran wanted to succeed this time. Heaven wasn't typically about success. It was drastically more common that spirits chose to relax in the afterlife, to retire, not to risk much or to try. Not so for Fran or his company mates. He wasn't done. He wanted more. They wanted more. They were going to keep trying at the thing they knew best, fighting the enemy. There was a price to that, however, which Fran knew only too well. He could get annihilated. He thought of his dear mom and imagined her saying, "Francis, we're so proud of you." And then he thought of his dad, a psychiatrist of the old school type, the leader of the Rues, and his role model in life and death. His dad would have said nothing out loud, but instead would have made the satisfied grin Fran remembered with such fondness. Dad, Fran thought, would have rubbed his hands together happily, and his deep blue eyes would have sparkled.
Scene 2, exterior Oak Park, Illinois.
Fran puffed on the cigar and recalled sitting on his front porch one evening in June, when he was first alive.
Franny boy, happy 18th birthday.
Thanks, Dad.
Jack sat down on a chair beside Fran. They looked out at the street together, at the sprawling oak tree that shaded there and their neighbor's front lawns, and at the beginnings of an urban sunset.
What's that you got? A beer?
I'm 18 now.
Fran's feet were up on the banister.
Huh, so you are. Where's mine?
Here.
Thanks.
Jack popped the top and had a draft.
Ooh, wow. This is real horse piss, Franny.
Yeah, pizza delivery doesn't pay so much as it sounds like.
Jack took out his pipe, packed the bowl with some Cavendish loose tobacco he kept in his blazer pocket, and lit it with a match.
So, what's the matter? Why so blue?
I'm not blue, Dad. Okay. Maybe a bit.
I thought so. Tell your old man what's on your mind.
But that's just it, Dad. I don't really know what is on my mind.
Well, in that case, if you don't know, can you describe what it feels like? Maybe sadness or stress, anxiety?
Feels like anxiety, I think.
Could it have anything to do with turning 18?
Maybe. This whole world, it's so messed up, Dad. I feel like just a speck in it, an ant. A busy, half-blind, pointless little ant.
Uh-huh. You're overwhelmed.
I am?
Or at least, whelmed.
What's the difference?
When you're whelmed, although you may still be half-submerged, you retain some options.
Then I'm whelmed, Dad.
What is it about your situation exactly? Too many choices? Too big a problem?
Maybe too many choices. I mean, we're graduating soon, and everyone else seems to know for sure what school they want and what they want to do. Finance, communications, economics, poli-sci. But I simply have no idea, Dad.
He looked over cautiously and let this last line drop.
I don't even know if I want to go to college.
Jack didn't flinch. He took another drink of the horse piss, thought a little, and replied,
"They have a plan."
Yes, they've all got their plan, all my friends.
And you don't?
Nope. I have no plan, no confidence in anything. I start to think on one idea, then switch to another, and then to another, and then it's back to the first thing.
Sounds like you're in a loop.
A loop. That's it. So what do I do now?
Give up?
What? Are you kidding me? Give up on having a plan for life.
Exactly.
And you get paid to give advice?
I do. Yes. So I do.
1, 2, here we go.
Scene 3. Interior Messiah's Pub, USS Synthesis.
He recalled once sitting in Messiah's Pub, a small Irish bar situated, strangely enough, aboard a naval vessel, the USS Synthesis. The Roues had congregated there immediately after an unlikely success in rescuing the infant spirit of little Anne Murphy from the devil's attempted possession. He pictured the company mates and friends who were on the mission with him there. His father, Jack O'Rourke. Deirdre Kavanaugh. His father's best friend, Joe Campbell. Two men who became like uncles to Fran, named István Kovács and Jacques-Jean François. And Fran's two new British mates, Ian and Morris. The third Brit of that group, Emmett, hadn't made it through their struggle with a demon named Sergeant Major Wolfowitz. Fran imagined for the 100th, or maybe the 1,000th time, what happened in that pub.
Deirdre!
What?
Deirdre, I have to tell you something.
Did you hear what Jacques just said?
No. What was it?
I think he's had too much to drink.
Well, I know he's had too much to drink. We all have.
She put her forefinger across her upper lip, signifying a mustache, and in a mock French accent said,
Monsieur is dead. They are too weak. That is why you have no lover. Even a Frenchman anymore would not be enough.
What did you say to that?
I told him not to worry. I would find someone who could keep up with me someday.
With that, she cast a sidelong glance at Fran, a corner of her mouth betraying a wily smile.
Well, Deirdre, that's kind of exactly what I wanted to talk with you about.
Oh, do tell, mon ami.
Well...
Well, what?
When it came to matters of the heart, Fran could suffer from indecisiveness, uncharacteristic of his life's other domains. This time, his inner willpower responded the moment that Deirdre closed that space between them. Better out than in, he decided.
Deirdre, I love you.
What was that?
I love you!
He knew she didn't have to say it back in that moment for him to know she loved him too.
Scene 4. Interior, Continental Palace, Saigon.
Lastly came Morozov himself, formerly Lieutenant Colonel, now a full bird colonel, Fedor Stepanovich Morozov. Fran and Dee used to refer to him as Hell's Duke. He gave the impression of accomplishment in life, but also of suffering, as if he had suffered more than you ever could.
You lost.
Lost what?
Morozov stood up and leaned on his cane.
The whole thing, the epic struggle, Samael and Adonai. They had a discussion about a week ago in which Adonai conceded humans are going to go extinct at last. That's what we thought this meeting was about.
The Roues looked at one another in a stunned silence. Kyoko and her bodyguard looked at one another similarly. The Red Horse's unit, in the know, remained calm.
Tell us more.
They met in Yosemite at the end of another drought. Adonai finally agreed that Homo sapiens have failed their test of leadership, and she's going to let them run themselves into extinction. No more interventions, no more messiahs. She's letting go the reins. Humans are going to burn the place up, experience overwhelming migration and unparalleled political unrest, starve themselves with famine, and kill themselves with combat, and probably unleash nuclear weapons in the end. That's what the future holds.
Morozov stood a little straighter, nodding to his companion. Brandy, statuesque and as composed as Morozov himself, somehow at ease with the trajectory of all humankind, flashed them all a bright smile.
So, no hard feelings and no reason we can't be friends now?
Wait, what? It's over? There's no way.
Oh? Then I'll prove it to you.
Scene 5. Exterior, hillside.
It had been awful between them the last time they discussed the humans. This was looking to be no exception.
I've never been able to understand why this particular failure has been so hard for you to accept, Adonai. Extinction has been the rule for most species, survival representing only an occasional, unlikely circumstance. Think of it. Over the years, we've had a dozen or more different hominids, and in just the last 500,000, we've had, what has it been, maybe 6 different human lines in the running. 6. Let's see. Homo neanderthalensis, Homo heidelbergensis, Australopithecus robust, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, and I'm sure I'm forgetting another one. Of course, Homo sapiens. 5 of those went extinct, and I didn't see you resist any of those like you resisted for the sapiens.
I really thought that this was the species.
As did I, my friend. We shared high hopes. Maybe, in retrospect, one of the other mammalian lineages would have been better.
We've been over this before, Samael. I don't think so. Besides, I gave this one my word.
That you did. I thought it optimistic, and I believe I expressed as much to you at the time. However, still, I am quite sorry for your disappointment.
I sent my son down to them. I'd never done such a thing before.
I saw that too. Now, if you ask me, there you were a bit over the top. A desperate move.
I was desperate.
I am sorry.
Samael waited longer this time, long enough for the sun to descend in the sky and bathe the horizon. What it was to have existed since the beginning and still find beauty in Adonai's creations. If only all the things crafted by her hands, given guidance by her words, could be as simple and pure as the sun.
They have to go. In another century, once they figure out what they've unlocked with the discovery of the Higgs boson, what will they do with that? It gives them new keys to the universe, but be honest with yourself. What inconceivable destruction and havoc will they wreak with those keys? I'll tell you what they'll do with them. Something terrible beyond a description. They'll unwind the fabric of all things and destroy space and matter on an unimaginable scale. The sapiens unlocking such fundamental particles, it's like giving a toddler a plutonium bomb. If they cannot control their urges, if they cannot control the size of their populations, if they cannot recognize the obvious effects of their behaviors, if they cannot steward the earth, then they are nowhere near capable of knitting and unknitting the building blocks of space and time. They'll destroy, quite literally, everything in this entire solar system, and perhaps others. Exchanging a minuscule boson or the barren moon for the green and blue planet and the space in which it resides, that, my lord and liege, would be a fool's trade.
What about our Anne Murphy? She's my last messiah. I'm excited about her.
She's a good one. But unfortunately, her odds of survival are low. She has many enemies already, and once she becomes president, her assassination will be assured.
Adonai looked as if she were coming to grips with a most unpleasant truth. She said to herself, as if in a trance,
"She's sweet as strawberries. Who could ever hate her?"
It's politics, my lord. There doesn't need to be a reason.
She sat down on a precipice overlooking the lush valley and buried her face in her two hands to hide her tears. She lamented through her fingers.
She was my last chance to turn things around.
Scene 6. Interior, Continental Palace, Saigon.
The hologram dissolved like the abrupt end of a nightmare. Joe, Jacques, Istvan, Deirdre, Ian, Morris, and Fran shared a cold sweat. Dumbstruck past coherence, Kyoko appeared almost equally shocked. Jack paced back and forth, intensely agitated, disbelieving what he'd seen with his own eyes. Brandy spoke once the break in the discussion had become excruciatingly long for her.
I have one last name I'd like to add.
The group startled. This hadn't been part of the plan. The news, the bomb. One moment they're focused on business as usual, the next...
Ian Murphy.
Absolutely not. She's a messiah. She's the last messiah.
That's why I want her. Cut the nonsense, Joe. You heard the man. It's over. It's done. Might as well finish it off.
There's no chance. She's off the table.
Jack put his hand onto the upright pole of a gas lamp to steady himself. Brandy scowled.
Then who is on? Is this meeting to waste our time? Murphy is a legitimate question, probably the most legitimate question we could entertain.
She's not a question at all, Brandy. She's ours and all ours. And besides, she's not at all anticipated to die anytime soon. She's not dying soon. Certainly not over the next year or few years.
Are you so sure about that?
Scene 7. Exterior, then interior, Tempest Station.
The new Tempest Station had made it easy for spirits of the afterlife to visit anywhere on contemporary Earth. Also to visit a growing number of influential times and places throughout humanity's past. Sparta, Samarkand, Mohenjo-Daro of the Indus Valley, Babylon, Jean Genot of sub-Saharan Africa, Cadiz, an ancient Rome, of course, Constantinople, Vienna, Xi'an, Tenochtitlan. New places and new times to visit sprouted up every month. Ever since the airport's recent unveiling, it had become an instant favorite feature of the afterlife. That didn't mean there weren't questions, though. There were more than a few spirits standing on the sidelines, not sure where to go or what to do. Each had the same kind of distant, bewildered look in their eyes. Yuf didn't know it, but he had the same look.
So, do people need jobs in heaven like they do on Earth? How does that work?
Nobody who doesn't want one really needs a job up here. You work for your own satisfaction, or you rest for your own satisfaction. And I say up here facetiously. We're really all sharing the same space on Earth. Only we're on a parallel plane of reality that overlays the ordinary one, and intersects here and there just a little bit.
He looked at her wide-eyed. Recognizing she might have lost him already, she clarified.
People always think of heaven as up in the sky, and hell as down below in the center of the Earth. But really, heaven and hell are more states of mind, allegiances, than physical locations.
Ah. I always imagine them as up and down.
Most do, at least as far as we know. There is talk of some physical places, of a physical heaven and a physical hell, but it's probably not what you imagine, and hard to know if it's actually true. If the places do exist, none of us intersect with them.
So, even you have never seen heaven or hell?
Heaven? I don't think so. Hell, definitely not. Heaven as a place is hard to find. And there's also talk that nobody who's visited hell has ever come back.
And the jobs?
Oof. Jobs. That's an interesting subject. Well, there's no money in the afterlife, and most spirits never die. So for those who work, think of it as the ultimate form of communism, if communism could have worked. But to an extraordinary degree, most spirits in heaven don't really work. They just sort of lay about, not asking for anything, never really doing anything. They're comfortable, worry-free, in a state called bliss.
Okay. Well, what's hell like then?
Most people in hell are just hanging out in this sort of everlasting bacchanalia.
Bacchanalia?
Party. A continuous party.
What about the everlasting torments of hell and all that I was raised up fearing?
Oh, you mean fire and brimstone and such? Well, that, it's a mistake. Or maybe an overstatement. Things might have been that way before, but if they were, they aren't any longer. Now it's just this meaningless kind of charade, where they're pretending they're happy. They think only of themselves, and they're perfectly useless.
To be honest, Fran and I think the average soul in hell isn't too different from the average one in heaven. They're different in style, but equally useless.
Heaven for the climate, hell for the company.
So you're in heaven, but you two don't exist in, what do you call it, bliss?
Correct. We are, and we don't. And others like us in the military don't. And there are many others not in the military who also don't. Scientists, priests, all kinds of types. Bliss is the majority, but a counterculture of spirits in heaven feel like the lifers down on Earth need whatever help they can get. And while it's not easy to cross over and help them, they try to do whatever they can. Not the ordinary kind of help for day-to-day things like help me with my exams or whatever. That's a sort of Blissville kind of effort. But for projects that require real heavy lifting, you got to reject those everlasting comforts and really give it a go.
Oh, well, that's nice of you.
But that's not everybody. Some spirits, like us, keep working, keep inventing, keep trying, or keep fighting. There are armies and navies in heaven, just like you're used to in ordinary life. And Fran and I are part of that tradition. Every afterlife sector has its opposition. And our main opposition, as you might expect, is hell. There is a third group out there. Spirits who you might consider as equivalent to druids. Or, in more modern terms, hippies. This group doesn't have interest in heaven or hell. They just want to be left alone.
Well, that's me, I think.
Fran frowned at this, and chose to ignore the comment.
So, there is this struggle going on right now over the fate of mankind. It's been going on for probably 10,000 years, but lately, it's reaching an absolute crisis. And this is absolutely top secret. I'm sure nobody here in this pub even knows of it, and this is a military crowd. So don't go peeping a word on it. We've just learned that recently, even God has gotten discouraged by humanity. Really discouraged. To the point of letting go. Our job, the Rue's job, is to go find God and try to turn this thing around.
Okay. Not that I don't appreciate hearing all this, but this has what to do with me?
Well, you've been approved by our CO to join our team, if you want. We were sent here specifically to find you.
What? I've never been recruited for anything before.
Congratulations, then. You're on for probably the most important mission there could be, or ever will be, right now. Are you in?
Scene 8. Interior. The Oval Office.
This time, her reverie got interrupted by the Oval Office's northwest door banging open. Noisily and abruptly, uninvited guests strode into the room with faces grim as a lynching. They formed a spontaneous half-circle around her, two guards in black tactical gear, as the guards around the White House often wore these days, entered with the others. Her chief of secret service followed and stood indiscreetly behind the group.
Do not make a scene.
A scene? A scene?
She reached into the top right drawer and pulled out a key.
I will not make a scene, General Montez.
She opened the upper of the two bottom drawers.
I would not want one of those.
She pulled out the Makarov, and because the guards were armed and menacing her, she pointed the gun at them.
I will give you one last chance to reconsider your coup d'etat and leave. I don't know what you think you found out about me, or how you've extorted the Vice President or the Secretary of State, but what you are attempting to do is absolute treason. Now, do as I say and leave this office.
The guards hesitated, but while the rest of the men in the room stood frozen in disbelief, the Chief Justice nodded at the guard on her right. The guard reached for his gun, lifted his arm, and pulled the trigger.
This preview of Rogues and Prodigies has been a production of Speaks Volumes, a division of TNP, LLC. Story by Paul Brian Roach. Story editor, Emily J. Conway. Engineered by Kathy Rook Murphy. Produced by Ralph Scott. And featuring the voices of narrator, Stacy Gonzalez. Fran, John Ellaby. Deirdre, K. Burfoot. Euphestus, Dave Jackson. Morozov, Joe J. Thomas. Brandy, Vanessa Singleton. Adonai, Maria Crocker. Joe, Mordecai Newman. Samael, Philip J. Mather. Jack O'Rourke, Joe J. Thomas. And playing President Murphy, Laura Copeland. For audiobook or serialized scripted entertainment inquiries, contact Speaks Volumes via email, info@speaksvolumes.biz. That's info@speaksvolumes.biz. Copyright 2020. Paul Brian Roach and Speaks Volumes, a division of TNP, LLC. All rights reserved. Speaks Volumes. Stories were meant to be heard. I'm your announcer, Michael Peacock. Be good. It's hell out there.